is the news.
A major U.S. airbase in western Iraq comes under a drone strike hours after a rocket attack on another U.S. base in Baghdad. A senior Israeli intelligence official warns of political violence in Israel after opponents of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced a deal to unseat him. And a delegation of three U.S. senators visits Taiwan, a move that is expected to spark an outcry from China. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to neighboring Iraq this hour, where a major U.S. military base in western Iraqi province of Anbar has been targeted by drones, the second such attack on the facility in more than a month. The Iraqi army says two drones were used in the attack on Ain al-Assad Air Base, adding that the UAVs were shot down by U.S. military's air defense system. Hours earlier, a rocket was also shot down above a U.S. base at the Baghdad airport. U.S. bases in Iraq have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over continued American military presence in the Arab country. Anti-U.S. sentiments escalated following the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in January of 2020. Israel's internal spying agency has warned of violence amid political infighting after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu launched a series of online attacks on his political opponents. In an extraordinary statement, Shin Bet's head, Nadav Argaman, said the agency has identified a serious rise in violent and inciting discourse on social media. He said these include references to treason by the now increasingly likely coalition of Netanyahu's opponents. Argaman warned that this could spark violence against the members of the coalition. Parties from the right, center, and left have announced a power-sharing deal to unseat Netanyahu, but he has blasted the new coalition, saying it endangers Israel and its security. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have attacked a sit-in protest in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli police arrested a correspondent covering the gathering from Al Jazeera News Network and damaged her crew's equipment. The move sparked condemnation from press freedom advocates. The rally was held to mark the 54th anniversary of Al-Naqsa Day, or a day of setback. The day is commemorated on June the 5th every year to mark the displacement of Palestinians from the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, following the Six-Day War in 1967. A senior leader of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the group only displayed half of its strength during the recent fighting with the Israeli regime.
We showed only half our strength. We managed to launch 130 rockets on Tel Aviv in one barrage, and we only launched our old rockets in the last campaign.
Yahya Sinwar reiterated that the Palestinian resistance emerged victorious in last month's fighting. He also warned that any future war with Israel will reshape the region. Palestinians' resistant groups dealt severe blows to Israel during the regime's 11-day aggression by firing 4,300 rockets. Israeli media say the massive rocket fire pushed Tel Aviv to beg the U.S. to mediate a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry says 253 Palestinians lost their lives in the Israeli offensive, including 66 children, and nearly 2,000 others were wounded. Meanwhile, thousands of people have gathered in central Rome to stage a pro-Palestine demonstration. protesters called on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Max Shavili brings us more in this report.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem or Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally, as on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the Rai national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh retaliatory drone strike successfully, hitting targets in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sadi said the strike hit the King Khalid Air Base near the city of Khamis, Mashhad. He said a Qassem 2K drone was used in the operation in response to Saudi Arabia's aggression and its continued siege of Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen back in March of 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom's war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead, many of them women and children. Yemen's Ansarullah movement blames the U.S. for the deteriorating humanitarian crisis in the impoverished country. It also says the U.S. has prolonged the war in Yemen by supporting Saudi Arabia's blockade on the impoverished nation. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, reports.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S. which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Ansarullah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Seven candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential vote have attended a televised debate. It's the first out of three presidential debates, which centered on the economy. Yusuf Jalali reports.
After days of campaigning for the upcoming presidential vote in Iran, candidates now stand toe-to-toe for a face-off. On Saturday, the seven runners attended the first televised debate, which was aired live on national television. Themed with economy, the first debate required the candidates to answer common questions, ranging from monetary policies to domestic production and boosting exports.
In order to boost domestic production, we need to reduce the taxes levied on our producers and in return increase the taxes on unproductive businesses, such as real estate or forex trading.
8 years ago, in the same place, I showed you a 10,000 rial banknote and warned you that if the current trend went on, our national currency would collapse. We need to take a different approach than using people's pockets to solve the government's problems.
We have prepared a package that consists of 213 projects. 51 of them are focused on harnessing inflation and controlling the prices.
When we speak about eliminating poverty, we're not just talking about basic rights, but it's also about entertainment and health policies. I have a comprehensive plan that can tackle these issues.
We need to turn our focus toward a 500 million strong market that exists in the region and not our 80 million strong domestic market. I mean, we need to strengthen our regional diplomacy and open up to the world to attract investment.
The debate started with random questions to each of the candidates, but got raucous after Abdel Nasser Hemmati picked on the other contenders, saying they're running to promote poverty rather than wealth.
Unlike the other candidates, I don't like to resort to lying to attract more votes. None of them is speaking of the distribution of wealth, but increasing poverty. I will pay equal attention to both creating wealth and its fair distribution.
Hemmati's comment was not left unanswered, as Ali Reza Zakani lashed out at him by reminding him of his poor performance as the head of the Central Bank of Iran, blaming him for the unprecedented devaluation of the national currency, the rial, which is currently traded at 240,000 against the U.S. dollar.
You have dealt an irreparable blow to the national currency, yet you accuse us of spreading poverty. You have already increased poverty during your tenure, while I speak of national production and boosting it. So please stop making accusations.
There are still two debates to go. The second and third debates will take place on Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will investigate the candidates' cultural and political policies.
While the debate offers an opportunity for each of the candidates to try to stand out and make the best impression to voters, it also gives a chance to the public to weigh up all the choices in one go. Yet, it's still too soon to judge about who stands a better chance to win the race, since the rivalry is still on. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has condemned the UN decision to temporarily revoke Tehran's voting rights in the General Assembly over its dues to the world body. Tehran argues that it's paid its dues to the world body regularly, and it's the economic sanctions that have made payments increasingly difficult for the country.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions.
A delegation of three U.S. senators has arrived in Taiwan's capital, Taipei, a move that is expected to spark an outcry from China. The senators, two Democrats and one Republican, say their trip is aimed at giving 750,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccines to Taiwan. Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth says the visit highlights Washington's bipartisan support for Taipei. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen has thanked the senators for delivering what she calls lifesavers to her country. Taiwanese Foreign Minister Joseph Wu has accused China of causing trouble for Taiwan and getting international aid to combat the pandemic. China considers Taiwan as its own territory and has already rejected similar charges leveled by the self-ruled island. However, China has criticized Japan for a recent donation of more than 1 million AstraZeneca doses to Taiwan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the massacre of civilians in Burkina Faso's Vahoto North. Guterres' spokesman said the United Nations underscores the urgent need for the international community to redouble support for the fight against violent extremism. Stefan Dujarric also said that the UN fully supports the authorities in their efforts to overcome the threats to peace, stability, and unity in the country. This comes after militants killed at least 138 civilians in two Burkinabe villages in the deadliest attacks since 2015. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the carnage, but Al-Qaeda-linked groups are known to be operating in the region. Burkina Faso, along with neighboring Mali and Niger, have come under frequent terrorist attacks during the past year. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Listeners special. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this Sunday, June 6, 2021. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails and letters. So contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. If you have any messages for our listeners around the world, then record your voice, send it to us, and then get your voice heard. Remember, dear listeners, Listeners Special, the Sunday program, is your program. It's your views that are important. And here, I do express my condolences to you on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ja'far Sadiq, the sixth infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you may know, these reception reports are very useful and important to us, especially to our technicians and engineers at IRIB English Radio. These reception reports actually enable us to provide a better service to our listeners throughout the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving a QSL card from us. And these days, as I have mentioned several times, my colleagues have prepared eQSL cards for our dear listeners around the world. And here, I appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Muhammad Shahid from India, Konstantin Provotor from Ukraine, one of our regular listeners, and Don Glocka from the US, also one of our regular listeners. So, Muhammad, Konstantin, and Don, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio, and many thanks for sending us reception reports. And here I also express my appreciation to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us letters and emails from around the world, including Paul R. Newton from the UK. Here we have a letter. Yes, it's a letter from Mike Yoniki. Mike Yoniki is from Canada. Here we have another email from Sultan Mahmoud Sarkar from Bangladesh. Sultan Mahmoud is one of our regular listeners. And from India, we have an email from Ratan Kumar Paul, also one of our regular listeners. And the last but not the least is a letter. This letter is from Brian Penny from the US, from Massachusetts. Dear listeners, many thanks for being with us after the music and after the break. I will be back with all these kind messages as I said, after the music. So please stay with us. I will be here after seconds. Welcome back. Here we have an email from Bangladesh. This email is from Sultan Mahmoud Sarkar. Sultan Mahmoud Sarkar is one of our regular listeners who says, "Hello, dear IRIB English Radio staff. At first, take my salam from Bangladesh. It is not surprising that the Zionist regime of Israel has persecuted the Palestinians. We only get accurate and sincere news of the Israeli regime atrocities against Palestinians through IRIB English Radio. Many thanks to IRIB English Radio for this. I wish you all good health and happiness, all the best." And salam and warmest greetings to you, Sultan Mahmoud Sarkar from Bangladesh, and many thanks for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. actually, it is not, as you said, it is not surprising that the fake regime of Israel has again recently launched another assault on Palestinians and has imposed forced evictions from their homes, from Palestinian homes. We cover the latest developments from around the world, including Palestine and the atrocities of the fake regime of Israel. And my colleagues around the clock work to cover the news, to cover the latest news from around the world. And actually, the news programs are prepared impartially and accurately. Many thanks for writing this email to us, Sultan Mahmoud Sarkar from Bangladesh. We are so happy that you enjoyed the news program of Arab English Radio. Write to us soon and tell us your views about other programs of IRB English Radio. And from India, we have an email from Ratan Kumar Paul. Ratan Kumar Paul is one of our regular listeners who says, "Greetings. I am Ratan Kumar Paul, a regular listener of your station. I do enjoy listening to your programs a lot, and I try to send you audio clips of your broadcast from time to time. Please verify my reception report with your QSL card and send some souvenirs for me if possible. Thanks." And salam and warmest greetings to you, Ratan Kumar Paul from India. Yes, you are one of our regular listeners, and we receive the audio clips of our broadcasts as you send them time to time, as you said. My colleagues will send you as soon as possible the EQSL cards that they have recently prepared, and we'll send you the souvenirs and promotional items of IRB English Radio as soon as possible. Anyway, many thanks for writing to our station, IRB English Radio. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRB English Radio programs. Again, many thanks, Ratan Kumar Paul from India, for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters from around the world. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we have received a letter. Yes, it's a letter from Canada, Ontario, Canada, from Mike Yuhinki. Mike says, "Dear sir or madam, I'm writing to let you know I heard your station on shortwave today. Though I tried to email this report, the email kept being returned, so here it is all but a short version just to let you know that your signal was heard here in Ontario, Canada. So I will end this, and again, great to pick up your signal on shortwave. I have been a broadcaster myself for some 20 years, and you do put together a very nice program. Thank you. First of all, salam and warmest greetings to you from Iran, Mike Yuhinki from Canada, Ontario, Canada. And lots of thanks to you for writing this letter to IRB English Radio. So our signals were received in your region, in Ontario, Canada, and that's great. And as you said, you're a kind of colleague to us. So yes, you said you're a broadcaster, and this is great that you enjoy our programs. As you described it, very nice program. Many thanks for writing this letter to us, and good luck in your job. And Mike Yuhinki from Canada, write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. It's an honor to have a broadcaster as a listener to IRB English Radio. So we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Mike from Ontario, Canada. And here we have another email. This email is from the U.S., is from Massachusetts, from Brian Penny. Brian Penny from the U.S. says, "Dear Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio, I received your broadcast to Europe and North America in English this afternoon. Reception conditions were nominal with minimal noise and fading. The modulation level of your broadcast was a bit low, but I was able to copy the majority of your transmission. If you find my reception report to be accurate, I would appreciate receiving a QSL from your station. An electronic QSL would be sufficient during this unprecedented pandemic. Brian Penny from Massachusetts, the U.S. And salam and warmest greetings to you, Brian Penny from Massachusetts. And many thanks for writing this letter to IRIB English Radio. So you received the signals of IRIB English Radio in your region, Cape Cod, as is mentioned in your letter. You mentioned that the reception conditions were nominal with minimal noise and fading. We refer to our engineers about this trouble and the the level of modulation as you described it. As you said, it was a bit low. Yes, we refer to our engineers and technicians about these problems and troubles because our effort in IRIB English Radio is, has been, and will be providing the best quality of the programs in IRIB English Radio. As you mentioned and as you've requested, my colleagues will send you an electronic QSL card, and that is because we are passing the days after days in this unprecedented pandemic, coronavirus pandemic. Yes, my colleagues will, as soon as possible, send you electronic QSL card. Many thanks for writing to IRIB English Radio. Brian Penny from Massachusetts, Cape Cod. Dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters from around the world. Please stay with us. Welcome back from the UK. We have an email from Paul R. Newton. Paul from the UK says, "Dear Sir or Madam, I heard your broadcast at 1945 UTC last night. Unlocking this morning in my WRTH 2021, the World Radio TV Handbook. I wasn't sure if it was Iran. I was using a frequency of about 6035 kilohertz. It kept changing slightly by about 5 kilohertz due to interference. Sound kept coming and going. I haven't heard shortwave radio for a while. I have already written to and heard in the last couple of days Romania, Turkey, Italy, and China. Thank you so much for your broadcast. First of all, salam and greetings to you, Paul R. from Newton, from the UK, and many thanks for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. So you had trouble, as you said, you kept changing slightly some kilohertz due to interference. So in order to have the correct information about our frequencies and also program schedule, please, Paul R. Newton from the UK, please refer to our website at www.parstoday.en, and there you can find the accurate and the correct information about IRIB English Radio frequencies and program schedule. Again, www.parstoday.com/en. So, Paul R. Newton from the UK, please, as you found the frequencies, please very soon let us know if you found the correct frequency address. Yes, please let us know about it. Anyway, Many thanks for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. Listen to IRIB English Radio programs and tell us your views about our programs, because your views are very important to us. Many thanks for writing to us. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Paul R. Newton from the UK. Dear listeners, before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, the Sunday program, again, I do express my condolences to you on the martyrdom anniversary of the sixth infallible era of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him. Many thanks for being with us and goodbye.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, it is not likely that any of the top brass of the Saudi Arabia at the start of their onslaught on Yemen thought that 6.5 years later they would still be fighting. And now it is the Yemeni military along with Ansarullah fighters who are now attacking Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman announced that Yemen had initiated retaliatory attacks inside of Saudi Arabia on the King Khalid military base in Nasser. Stay with us as we take a look at how the tables have turned on the Saudi regime.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jizan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia, and that is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
I'd like to welcome my guest to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Elijah Makian, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto, and Zafar, how could the Saudis have miscalculated Yemen this much? I mean, they thought the war would not take more than a month or two. Your assessment?
Well, basically, the Saudi defense minister, who is now also the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, when he was first appointed, he was full of arrogance. He thought that the Saudi army, because it is equipped with a lot of weapons, would be able to wipe out any Yemeni resistance. But what he did not realize was, number one, that the Saudi army is not motivated. In fact, they are not really capable of fighting. Number two, they underestimated the Yemenis' resistance. The point is that the Yemenis are fighting for their land, for their honor, for their principle. What the Saudis are doing is they are the aggressors. They want to occupy somebody else's land, and they want to install a puppet regime in Yemen. Obviously, that is not acceptable to the Yemeni people. Secondly, the Saudis counted on a number of mercenaries. In fact, they approached a number of countries, including countries like Pakistan and Egypt and so on, hoping that they would send their armed forces to support the Saudis, and these countries refused. So the Saudis had to resort to mercenaries from South America, from Africa, from Sudan, etc. But naturally, even these mercenaries cannot continue to wage a war on behalf of the Saudis. So as you mentioned, it's been more than 6 years, and I think the Saudi army and their soldiers, etc., have realized that this is a lost cause, and the best thing is not to put up a fight, and in fact, many of them are surrendering.
Well, Elijah, the Saudis initiated a ruthless onslaught on Yemen back in 2015, bombing civilian areas and infrastructure, and also implementing a land, air, and sea siege of the area. I mean, what was Riyadh really trying to accomplish with this type of violence against the civilian population in Yemen?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
There are 2 points. First of all, Saudis are trying to submit Yemen to its control because Yemen is considered its backyard. And secondly, they are afraid of the influence of Iran in Yemen. This is what the Saudis tried, started the war, thinking that it is a promenade, and thinking that in a matter of weeks this will end. It has been 6 years, and during these 6 years, the Yemeni learned how to make their own bombs, have learned the art of war, and they have also learned how to retaliate. And what we have seen very recently, recently in the last 24 hours how the Yemeni are taking the initiative and attacking Jazan and making really strong progress. Now, what Saudi Arabia is doing is really destroying Yemen. The cost of war so far is estimated around $100 billion. And the only thing that Saudis have achieved so far is the destruction of the country, where there is the largest humanitarian crisis ever against the poorest country in the Middle East. We saw the Yemenis are learning how to fight back, how to make missiles, and how to do their own drones and armed drones, and how to retaliate and hurt Saudi Arabia. And I think now the Saudis are trying to find a way out, but they want to gain in negotiation what they failed to gain in the war.
Okay.
Therefore, the Houthis... Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just get Zafar back in on this discussion. Well, although the Yemenis have been under a Saudi siege, Yemeni fighters and Houthis have continually improved, so much so that they are now attacking Saudi Arabia. What do you attribute this to? I mean, how are they able to do this despite the siege?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that the Yemenis are one people that have never, ever surrendered to foreign forces. So that goes to their credit. Secondly, as your guest pointed out, the Yemenis have been able to make immense progress in terms of developing their military capabilities. Yemen already had actually a missile industry before the Saudis launched a war against them, but it was not as advanced as it has become now. And thirdly, the Saudi army, they're not only totally incompetent, they're also demoralized. So what the Yemenis have been able to do is, because of their determination, because of the fact that their cause is just, they are fighting to defend their own land. They're not committing aggression. In fact, even the operations that they are carrying out inside Saudi Arabia in provinces like Jizan and Asir, these actually belong to the Yemeni people. These were illegally occupied by the Saudis in 1934. So perhaps this Saudi aggression against Yemen that was launched in March of 2015 may turn out to be a blessing in disguise for the Yemenis, despite the enormous sacrifices that they have had to make, but that they perhaps might be able to reclaim the land that the Saudis had illegally occupied back in 1934. So their cause is just, they are highly motivated, they are excellent fighters, they have never surrendered to any foreign forces. All of these factors actually go in favor of the Yemeni people.
Okay. Well, Elijah, I mean, how significant in your perspective that we've seen the Yemeni forces just attacking a military base by drone inside of Saudi Arabia, and we've seen other retaliatory attacks and dealing with oil tankers. How disruptive has this been?
I think that had significant effect on Saudi Arabia economy, reputation, and finance. We saw how the Yemeni were able to disrupt the oil flow from Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world for several days, and even for a couple of weeks. And we saw how the Yemeni were able to head inland in Saudi Arabia and to give back the same amount of, not the same amount, but to retaliate in Saudi Arabia in different area, even going toward far in Saudi Arabia, so 1,200 kilometers. We saw how the Yemeni were capable to force the Saudis to the negotiation table. Unfortunately, the Americans are negotiating on behalf of the Saudis now in Sana'a, and not the Saudis, because they don't have the skills or the courage to negotiate.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Elijah talked about the Americans negotiating on behalf of the Saudis. Your perspective on the United States, do you think that at this point in time that they want this war to end? Are you detecting some type of changing perspective coming out of Washington? Are your assessment overall?
Well, the Americans are actually trying to change the perception but not their policy. So while Biden and his regime continues to talk about not providing offensive weapons to the Saudis, but we have seen no evidence that they have stopped supplying weapons to the Saudis or that they are still providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis. So these negotiations that are taking place under UN auspices regarding Yemen, obviously, as Elijah pointed out, these are basically guided by the Americans, because America virtually controls the United Nations, and so it is actually dictating the agenda. But what is important and crucial for your viewers to understand is that the Yemenis, throughout this war on them, have maintained the high moral ground. The Saudis have been attacking civilian infrastructure. The Yemeni Ansarullah fighters have not attacked any civilian infrastructures. They have targeted military installations. They have targeted economic installations. There was only one instance, in fact, when the Yemenis fired a missile at a palace in which they thought the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was staying. So throughout these 6+ years, the Yemenis have only targeted military installations because they do not believe in inflicting civilian casualties, although they can. So on these counts, I think the Yemenis really maintain the high moral ground, and they are fully justified in not accepting any demands that the Americans make of them.
Well, Elijah, what about Riyadh itself? Do you think it is looking for a way to end this war now?
Riyadh is really willing to come out of this problem that Saudi Arabia put itself in, and we cannot exclude the meeting, the couple of meetings that happened between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad, where the Saudis on the top of their agenda was the situation in Yemen. And we saw how Minister Zarif went to Muscat, Salam, to slow down on the base that the Saudis will lift the siege. And the Yemeni made it very clear, we cannot stop the war on our side because the Houthis are now dictating the battle. They said we cannot stop the war on our side unless you lift the siege, and we will not accept an exchange of ceasefire in exchange of humanitarian aid. You allow us to survive. You allow us to live. We want the 16 ships that are full of oil. There is no oil in Yemen today, and we want all the aids before we start talking about a ceasefire. Today, Saudi Arabia is trembling of the idea that the Houthis are going to liberate Marib, and this is going to happen very soon. And I think they will liberate Marib and get their oil rich before accepting a ceasefire.
Okay. Well, Zafar, there seems to be a unique strength and determination in the Yemeni people. I mean, what is it that makes them so determined, although the Saudi regime is killing civilians on a regular basis, as well as destroying the infrastructure, restricting basic necessities, and at least 16 million Yemenis are estimated to be food insecure out of a population of 29 million, and they have refused to surrender to the Saudi regime. And you touched on this a bit, but I'd like for you to expand on it.
Sure. Basically, as I mentioned, the Yemeni people are absolutely brilliant fighters. There are very few other people in the world, perhaps I might even mention the Afghans, who have defeated now the third superpower of their time. But the Yemenis are absolutely determined fighters. But what is also very crucial to keep in mind is that the Yemenis don't rely only on weapons, they rely on their faith. They have a firm conviction in God's help. They are very, very determined people. They are very pious people. As I mentioned, they have not targeted civilians in Saudi Arabia, although they are quite capable of doing it, which shows that they have maintained the high moral ground. They have maintained their dignity and their honor in the face of all of these extremely difficult conditions that have been imposed upon them. I mean, you know, a country that is under total siege, they cannot get food in, they cannot get oil in, and, you know, millions of people are starving. More than 1 million children are afflicted by cholera epidemic. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of in recent history. And yet, the Yemenis have maintained their dignity and honor because they have such strong commitment to Allah and to Islam, mm-hmm. and they want to maintain that, and that is the reason why they have been successful. And I think we should take heart from this fact that whenever Muslims, regardless of where they are, for instance, you can look at the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, again, the commitment of the people of Palestine and their firm commitment to Allah has provided them these opportunities. So I think this is a very important lesson for Muslims worldwide,
okay.
that instead of relying on weapons, they can rely on the help of Allah and remain steadfast.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You heard Zafar, he talked about Palestine. I want to look at this because something else unique about the Yemenis, at the despite all of the hardships that we've just mentioned, some of them, they've recently been raising money for the Palestinians after the situation that took place 11 days Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They have been busy raising money and giving support to the Palestinian cause despite them being under such pressure. Now, both of these groups, it's interesting, if we look at the similarities of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Yemen, both under siege, and the resistance despite this pressure both being effective. Your take on this?
This is a very important question. Apart from the touching move of the Yemeni, who are really starving and have very little asset, they managed to put together over $200,000. I mean, look at the amount they managed to put together to send it to Gaza and to support the Palestinian population. This gest is very significant, but the most significant, we see how the axis of the resistance that goes from Yemen to Tehran, to Baghdad, to Syria, Damascus, and to Lebanon, and to end in Gaza, how it is all compact and it's holding together. When Yemen came out and said, we are waiting for Gaza to tell us if they need us to fight and to support them, this is extremely significant, because that is the work of all these years, to bring out a line of population ready to fight against the aggressor, whoever they are, wherever they are, whoever they are, because even if they are very strong, the people of Yemen express their solidarity with Gaza to tell them that you are not alone and this whole front is here to support you. The creation of this front is the most significant issue in all of this.
Zafar, your take on this resistance front and being in solidarity now, of course, had been before, but definitely seeming to be even more effective than it has been. Your assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, as we see these developments unfold, a resistance front is gaining more and more strength. And this clearly indicates that the resistance front, which obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran is a major component of, has been motivated to a level whereby these resistance fighters are not guided by any worldly considerations, but in fact, they are determined to uphold truth and justice, whether it is in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the rest of Palestine, in Iraq, where they are facing this American occupation, or in Syria, which again is has been subjected to the horrendous mercenary onslaught from all over the world, and of course with the American forces over there. But the fact that the Islamic Republic was upfront in supporting Syria, because Syria is a very, very important component for the resistance front in order to be able to provide material support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as material support to the people of Gaza. So we see that the resistance front is actually operating on very high moral principles and upholding justice and fairness. And I think any people that stand up for truth and justice and show solidarity, I think ultimately they will triumph.
And Elijah, your take, now that not only the resistance front, but we look at Yemen itself, the military and Ansar Allah, the Houthis are getting stronger by the day. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel as far as this war? Do you think that we're heading towards the end of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen?
Actually, I do, because today we see the axis of the resistance.